You're not in power. As a person, normal, common person.
I don't know, just probably frown at them and walk off. And you're like, you know, you shouldn't be doing
so
that.
So we can't
kind of
do much, technically.
No, yeah, Ayn al-Munkar, it takes many shapes and forms, right? Mm-hmm. If at the very least you can show that you're not happy with that act. I don't know. You
yes,
know, it depends
just
on the
facial impressions.
If it's a sister in the street and her hijab isn't mm-hmm. good, for example, I'd prefer just not to get involved at all. You know, but if it's a brother and he's in the month of Ramadan and he's doing something, you know, eating or something, then maybe I'd do something. And I do believe that a lot of these issues do come down to the implementers of the laws, especially in an Islamic country.
Mm-hmm.
Educating people is good. And yeah, that's the primary option. And that's mm-hmm. that's the ideal state that we want to reach. But 99% of people are, you know, they won't be educated. Maybe 99 is a little bit steep, but
yeah.
the majority of people, you know, أكثرهم لا يعلمون, most of them,
that is
most
the
of them
point.
Don't know, right? And that's just the nature of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we give human beings a lot of the benefit of the doubt. Even in non-Muslim countries, if we see that people are behaving in a certain way and it appears civilized, we should recognize that actually if a lot of the laws were removed, those same people would turn into the worst kind of animals. You know, there's a reason why the Ten Commandments, you know, one of the first laws is thou shalt not kill.
Mm-hmm.
It's natural to assume that human beings should know this without having to be told that killing somebody else is bad. But no, human beings are such. Laws have to be implemented to control society. Otherwise, everything would just go haywire.
Now, brother, you were talking that if you see some negative behavior in the society, you would just prefer not to get involved with those people. Now, I have a question from you. Do you prefer to have some authorities, to have some stronger, some people in power to interfere? Do you think that there must be some people like that in society in which ask people not to do such things?
Yeah, there should be. There should be a kind of organized force
mm-hmm.
Which has the power of government behind them, which will go into society and stop certain evils from taking place. It's a very natural phenomenon, actually. I'll give you an example from the West. It has become law that teachers have to teach children under the age of 6, right? So
mm-hmm.
5-year-olds, 4-year-olds. About absolutely obscene things that I can't even mention here to do with reproductive organs of human beings and
yes.
stuff, right? Now, I don't want my child to be educated in that way, for example,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, if I choose to pull my child out of those classes, there is a likelihood that I will actually be punished for that and the child could be taken out of my custody,
oh.
right? So this is the way that the taghut and the evildoers have implemented a system
mm-hmm.
whereby evil is actually promoted and enforced upon society.
Yes.
The general population is helpless in the face of this. This is the way that governments work. Now, if you have the government in your power as a Muslim, you have to do the same thing, but like in terms of enforcing, but what you enforce should be good
exactly.
rather than evil, right? So this idea of enforcing the certain things, you know, when we look at the verse La ikraha fid din,
mm-hmm.
right, there is no compulsion in religion, we think that that's just a blanket statement and therefore everybody is free to do whatever they want in the sense that, you know, society can choose for themselves what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. If we look before that and after that, Allah Himself gives us the context. He says, "Qad tabayyana ar-rushdu min al-ghayy." Surely,
so you know the truth.
Right.
You know what
been,
is wrong
yeah.
and what is
right. And then after that, so that's more talking about the aqaid of people, the beliefs of people. Obviously,
mm-hmm.
you can't change the beliefs of people. You can't force people to have iman, but the laws that you implement in society, which are designed to protect people and help them to grow spiritually, mentally, physically, economically, financially, in every way, yeah, those laws should be implemented.
So, yes, thank you. I think that's all the time we've got for today's episode. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell, and I leave you to the God's never-sleeping eyes.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
With the re-election of President Emmanuel Macron, France's mainstream media has stopped worrying about fascism and started to honestly discuss the state of the country. A France divided is the most common headline. In 2017, Macron promised to not give France a reason to vote for the extremes of the political spectrum, but the far right and the far left have both grown to new highs.
It's a good thing Macron was re-elected. We need a young, efficient, pro-European president with a long-term vision. I'm surprised at the high score for the National Front, but in their economic program, they forget that it's the bosses who are in charge of salaries and not the president.
Le Pen won just 5% of the vote in the capital, while out of 101 departments, she carried 30 of them, mostly rural. She secured just one department in 2017. 80% of voters described the presidential campaign as being of poor quality, and few desired a rematch of 2017.
I didn't vote in the second round. In the first round, I voted for third place finisher Jean-Luc Mélenchon and decided to abstain. I think it's better than Macron won instead of Le Pen, who is too extreme right for me.
Macron's problem is that once again, he can't claim his win signifies a broad mandate for his proposals. Subtract 39% of the total electorate due to abstention and purposely spoiled ballots, and Macron's 58% of the vote falls to just 35% of the electorate. If we fairly assume that, like in 2017, 43% of his voters only did so to block Le Pen, then just 20% of the total electorate chose Macron for his policies or personality. That's a drop of 4 points from 2017. If Macron continues to rule as if his policies don't need a broad popular mandate, then France's permanent social unrest seems likely to continue. A Le Pen victory would have set off immediate protests, but for now, a calm resignation is reigning. However, few expect the Paris street or the rural roundabout to remain quiet for very long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of this international conference that drew political figures and activists from across the world to Tehran to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their struggle against Israel's occupation.
The message of the conference here is for expressing unity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters who are suffering and who are struggling for their independence and their sovereignty.
The centrality of the issue of Palestine for the Muslim world is what we want to remind some of the Arab states that ignored this fact and contemptibly normalized their ties with the criminal regime of Israel despite the will of their nations. Some Arab leaders must be ashamed even more now when we see that the Israelis are attacking Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli forces have repeatedly attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound site since early April, with the onset of the holy month of Ramadan, which coincided with Jewish Passover. Last week, more than 150 Palestinian worshippers were injured when Israeli forces stormed the compound in the occupied city of Al-Quds. The regime has pressed ahead with its violence at the Flashpoint site and has been cracking down on solidarity protests throughout the occupied West Bank.
What is happening today in Palestine has been repeated for the last 72 years. Added to that today, the crimes of Israelis has exceeded all the human rights and all war crimes. UNESCO itself has declared that Al-Aqsa Mosque is an Islamic sanctity, is an Islamic place. It has nothing related to the Jewish religion. What is the relevance to the extreme Zionist Jewish settlers to get into the mosque and pray over there? There is no relation to them over there. What we want today is that the international community has to understand that Israel has violated the freedom of worshipping rights.
This conference is held ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. Activists here regard Quds Day as an opportunity to shed light on the Israeli crimes in Palestine and hope that it would instigate the international community to take action in support of Palestinians.
Delegates here say Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, calling on Muslims worldwide to participate in the International Quds Day en masse. They say this is the only way to bring the Palestinian cause to light amid attempts by Tel Aviv to sweep its crimes under the rug. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The EU and its Western allies continue to pour hundreds of millions of euro worth of deadly weapons into Ukraine. Speaking in India on Monday, the head of the bloc's executive arm, Ursula von der Leyen, defended this policy.
Our response to Russia's aggression today will decide the future of both the international system and the global economy.
Just last week in the European Parliament, a number of legislators questioned the wisdom of pumping lethal weapons into Ukraine.
If there is a ceasefire, who's going to disarm those individuals who are receiving these arms? We know how weapons sent to fight Al-Assad in Syria ended up being used for attacks in other countries.
Also, it's clear many EU citizens are against the enormous militarization of Ukraine by the West.
If you send weapons, maybe you will encourage the conflict.
We all must hope the world need peace.
I think the peace is the best way.
Weapon is not the answer to nothing.
Poverty is on the rise in the EU, and so campaigners say the huge amounts of money being spent on providing weapons for the conflict could be better spent.
People are faced with the COVID crisis, you know, with energy crisis, you know, the bills of people are tripled or even quadrupled. So it's something ununderstandable.
But the European Commission insists the arming of Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict.
The war can stop today if Russia decides that it should stop. It has nothing to do with the arms deliveries to Ukraine. Ukraine is only defending itself.
However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Otherwise, they suggest, there is no way of ending this conflict. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hundreds of protesters flocked to central London on Sunday to honor the call of International Quds Day. The annual event, held on the last weekend of Ramadan, was initiated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979 to express solidarity for Palestinians and staunch opposition to Zionism.
Israeli aggression against Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan has become so regular that it's turned almost regrettably into an annual tradition. That's why tensions are so high this year, as continued aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is ongoing even at the time of this recording.
Due to its popularity, many attempts have been made by pro-Israel groups to ban the rally, with critics citing anti-Semitism accusations. Event supporters, however, rubbished these claims.
The Al-Quds demonstration is in support of the Palestinians in their fight against Zionism. Zionism is a totally different philosophy to Judaism. Zionism is a false, secular philosophy. Judaism is an age-old religion. Being against Zionism is being against falsehood. Nothing to do with anti-Semitism at all.
The very fact that the protest movement is being criminalised and there are efforts to ban it, I think that speaks volumes. They don't want concepts of resistance to be spoken about. Like, I'm not sure if you realise in some of the protests, there's an emphasis on 1, 2, 3, 4, occupation no more, but not an emphasis on 5, 6, 7, 8, Israel is a terrorist state, right? It's like, we have solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians. We call out their victimhood, but we also target the aggressor.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque compound has been at the centre of weeks of heightened Israeli violence against Palestinian worshippers since the beginning of the Holy Month. With at least 19 Palestinians killed so far, fears remain high that another full-scale war could break out as Gaza's resistance threatens greater retaliation. Robert Carter, London.
Amid the Israeli escalation against Palestinians, Yemenis have held a conference called Palestine, the Central Cause of the Nation, in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Senior officials have participated in the event to express their support for Palestinians.
The conference was held in Sana'a, the capital, which represents a symbol of a steadfastness and resistance in the face of those who normalize relations with the Israeli enemy. The Yemeni people are a living example of free people, as the central issue for us is Palestine. If Yemen was still ruled by the previous regime, it would have been portrayed as having normalized relations with Israel. But praise be to God, the Yemeni people have been liberated.
Organizers said this conference is a preparation for the celebration of the International Quds Day, as Yemenis will fill the streets of Sana'a to prove their solidarity with the Palestinian cause.
This conference comes as part of preparations for marking Quds Day, which will be unprecedented this year, as the Yemeni people will come out to confirm that Palestine is the central issue of the nation. The message that we are sending through this conference is that the Yemeni people, with all their sects and components, insist that the Palestinian cause is the basis for the solution to all the problems facing the Islamic nation.
During the conference, the president of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, called for forming official and popular funds to support the Palestinian people and returning the Palestinian issue to the curricula to emphasize its importance for all generations.
Despite everything that is currently happening in the world and the catastrophic situation in the country, people who say they will never forget the Palestinian cause, they say it is the time for the free people of the world to prove their support for Palestinians against ongoing Israeli crimes.
Israel, since its creation, has always touted itself as invincible, especially because of possessing advanced weapons and receiving unwavering military, intelligence, and financial support from the West, in particular the United States. Nonetheless, the myth of Israel's invincibility has been shattered over the past years as the regime suffered severe blows in the face of fierce resistance by the Palestinians, both in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Irrespective of the casualties Israeli forces have sustained in the West Bank in response to their crimes against Palestinians, retaliatory attacks in Israeli cities have turned the spotlight on the regime's vulnerability. Since March 22nd this year, Palestinians have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations in Israel, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Such retaliatory operations reflect the fact that Israel will have to brace itself for an armed resistance inside its cities. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, the regime's spying fiasco also made headlines after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's much-vaunted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September 2021, six Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Likewise, a spate of successful hacking attacks, which have broken into the servers of major Israeli companies, further exposed the weakness of the regime's intelligence service. But resistance against Israel is not restricted to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank alone. Other resistance groups, such as Lebanon's Hezbollah, have dealt severe blows to the regime in response to its acts of aggression. The multifaceted attacks against Israel have devastated the regime's illusion of invincibility and its dreams of ruling from the Nile to the Euphrates.
The 16th session of the Quds Conference for Palestinian Youth was held in Damascus. Participants discussed means of uniting Palestinians in service of their cause, hailing resistance operations in occupied Palestine and the people's uprising in the face of Israeli forces.
Our message in this conference is that Palestinian youth outside Palestine are present on the front lines, just like the youth in Quds, Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinians are uniting. The Sword of Palestine battle reflects this unity, and this conference is one of the results of that battle.
The conference is held in parallel with the International Al-Quds Day, which was set by late Imam Khomeini on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan every year.
The message of Iran on Quds Day is that the only path for regaining Palestinian rights is resistance against the crimes of the Zionist entity. The message of Quds International Day is Islamic unity in the face of Israeli crimes. The track of normalization will not affect regaining Palestinians' rights.
We, as Palestinian, Syrian, and Arab youth, send a message to our people in Quds, in Aqsa Mosque, that we will support them until the liberation of Palestine, from the sea to the river. Thanks to the Resistance Alliance, today we are more capable of triumphing. And as Imam Khamenei said, Quds will remain the axis.
The final communique called for national unity among all Palestinian factions, as well as re-establishing the PLO with the national plan based on resistance against the Israeli enemy. Events like this reiterate that Palestinian refugees across the world will never give up their right of repatriation. It's a message to Israel that their struggle will never stop until ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
French President Emmanuel Macron has been re-elected in a comfortable victory, defeating the National Rally's Marine Le Pen, just like in 2017. 6 years after Brexit and the election of Donald Trump, France has still not had a shock victory which opposes right-wing economics and globalization. Macron's victory will be celebrated by high finance in Brussels and by the so-called bourgeois bloc, who are his core supporters. However, the Yellow Vests have said for months that they view a Macron victory as intolerable and as a call to social battle.
Ça veut dire qu'on aura fait trois ans de lutte.
We had 3 years of a struggle but couldn't get Macron out of power. It shows that there is no solution possible by the ballot, only on the streets. Many people will be quite desperate, so things could turn towards extreme social instability and maybe civil war.
Le Pen did see a major rise in support as compared with 2017, but the nationalist bloc still fell short. It seems that many voters simply could not vote in favor of even a rebranded National Front, whose far-right record goes back decades. Abstention hit 28%, the highest since 1969. Blank or purposely spoiled ballots are estimated to be an additional 12%. The populist bloc, who apparently wanted neither candidate, made their presence felt by denying Macron a convincing victory in terms of the overall electorate.
The biggest revolution to come will be philosophical and intellectual.
We need a new way of thinking, a new way of being French, and we need a new France. With Le Pen or Macron, we were sure to lose our democratic rights and personal freedoms, and that's unacceptable to many.
Just like in 2017, Macron is likely to face calls that his victory is not a mandate for his proposed policies, such as raising the retirement age this fall. That means the country is likely to experience continued social unrest, which was unprecedented in Macron's first term. France's political future usually first surfaces in their neo-imperial colonies, like with the Yellow Vests. For the first time, the far right won most of France's overseas territories in what could be a preview of 2027. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents, and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Melad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Melad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Melad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father after the attack on school students. Mir Hussein went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Human values are alien to the Zionist regime. Imam Khomeini. Everybody together, unanimously, with one voice, present at the glorious demonstration of God's Day.
In the limelight.
Activists condemned the recent announcement by the Biden administration that the U.S. Bureau of Land Management will resume oil and gas lease sales on public lands as yet another betrayal of President Joe Biden's promises to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and tackle the climate emergency. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Climate Activists Condemn Biden's Reopening of Oil and Gas Leases on Public Lands. Here's the story. activists condemned the recent announcement by the Biden administration that the U.S. Bureau of Land Management will resume oil and gas lease sales on public lands as yet another betrayal of President Joe Biden's promises to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and tackle the climate emergency. The U.S. Interior Department explained that the lease sale resumption is in compliance with a 2021 federal injunction blocking the Biden administration from enforcing a temporary pause on new leases for oil and gas drilling on public lands and waters. The department described the onshore oil and gas lease sales as significantly reformed, while announcing a first-ever increase in the royalty rate for new competitive leases to 18.75%, up from the 12.5% minimum rate required by law. While the progressive watchdog Accountable US applauded the administration's decision to raise the royalty rate, most climate campaigners decried the resumption of the fossil fuel lease sales amid a worsening planetary emergency. Varshini Prakash, executive director of the Youth-led Sunrise Movement, said, "It is never a good sign when the president announces something at 5 p.m. on Friday. But President Biden can't get away with this disastrous climate decision. The fact of the matter is that more drilling won't solve high gas prices right now. So why is Biden breaking his campaign promise to stop drilling on public lands?" The Western Environmental Law Center noted that the communities most at risk from new fossil fuel extraction are primarily Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. People of the global majority and those on the front lines of fossil fuel industry expansion. These are the same communities that turned out in record numbers to get Biden elected in 2020 and who have since been urging Biden to use his executive authority to fulfill his campaign promise and ban new federal fossil fuel projects. Randy Spivak, Public Lands Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, argued that the Biden administration's claim that it must hold these lease sales is pure fiction and a reckless failure of climate leadership. It's as if they're ignoring the horror of firestorms, floods, and megadroughts and accepting climate catastrophes as business as usual. She added, "These so-called reforms are 20 years too late and will only continue to fuel the climate emergency. These lease sales should be shelved and the climate-destroying federal fossil fuel programs brought to an end." Colin Rees, U.S. Program Manager at Oil Change International, asserted that, "In the midst of a climate emergency and a fossil-fueled war that has exposed the dangers of fossil fuel dependency, President Biden's decision to double down on leasing new public lands for fossil fuel development is a disastrous choice." Rees continued, "There is no amount of regulation that can change the facts. Significantly reformed oil and gas lease sales will still result in selling off our public lands for deadly extraction that's hurting communities and driving the climate crisis. Increasing royalty rates may even result in furthering state and federal reliance on oil and gas leasing revenue, just as the science is clear that we need to be stopping all expansion of fossil fuel extraction." This is an ugly betrayal of Joe Biden's campaign promises and his administration's rhetoric on environmental justice and climate action. Biden is choosing to stand with polluters over people at the expense of frontline communities and the future of the planet. True energy independence means rejecting fossil fuel expansion and public lands and beyond. True energy independence means rejecting fossil fuel expansion and ending big oil's greed while rapidly building out renewable energy on public lands and beyond. Nicole Geo, Senior Fossil Fuels Program Manager at Friends of the Earth, recalled that, as a presidential candidate, Biden promised to end new oil and gas leasing on public lands, but now he's prioritizing oil executive profits over future generations. Nicole Geo, Senior Fossil Fuels Program Manager at Friends of the Earth, also added, Biden's Interior Department has even issued permits to drill at a rate faster than the Trump administration. Now, the Bureau of Land Management is preparing to hold its first public land lease sale, despite having no legal obligation to do so. If Biden wants to be a climate leader, he must stop auctioning off our public lands to big oil. Sunrise Movement's Prakash warned of electoral consequences for Biden's failure to fulfill his climate promises, which included a pledge that there would be no more drilling on federal lands, period. The president has already come under fire from climate and environmental campaigners for his plan to auction more than 80 million acres of the Gulf of Mexico to fossil fuel companies, an effort that was blocked by a federal judge in January.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. This series of the program, The Teacher, is about the lives and the works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries, scholars, philosophers, jurisprudents, faqis, and ulama all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Sheikh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Today we want to talk about one of the most outstanding fuqaha, the Shiite fuqaha of the 13th century Hijra. He's no one but Murtaza Ansari Desfuli, mainly known as Sheikh Murtaza Ansari or Sheikh Ansari, Sheikh Al-Ansari. Different titles and different attributes were given to him, but the most outstanding one was Khatam al-Fuqaha wal-Mujtahideen, and he is regarded as one of the most outstanding fuqaha who brought some innovations into the field of usul and usul al-fiqh and fiqh, in general, by writing the books Rasa'il and Makasib, which are really among the most outstanding books that are taught in the Islamic houses all across the world of Islam. Of course, the Shiite world, whether Mashhad, whether Najaf, whether the holy city of Qom, Isfahan, and other places. And we want to talk about these books and the methodology of Sheikh Ansari in writing such books. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you. Give us a short biography of Sheikh Murtaza Al-Ansari, because it's really interesting for some of dear listeners to be more familiar with his early life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Murtaza Ansari, being born in 1214, according to lunar calendar, the beginning of the 13th century, in the north city in the province of Khuzestan, which is called Desful. He was born to a religious family, as this is said that no doubted it that he is from the descendant of Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. Yeah. And when we look at the family he is born to and his lifestyle, we can confirm this. In all aspects of his life, we can see the love upon Ahlul Bayt. We can see his action and worshipping action. It was all corresponding with the pure Islam.
They say that the mother of Sheikh Ansari dreamt Imam al-Sada giving a golden Quran to him.
Yeah.
And most of the mu'abbarin, I mean the interpreters of the dream, said that this is a good news for you, that a son, a righteous son, will be given to you. And the role of the mother here is really important, nurturing Sheikh Al-Ansari, you know, breastfeeding the child when in wudu, you know.
She was trying to always breastfeed him when she was at the state of
wudu,
tahara, that's right. So when we look at his lifestyle, we see that when he reached 18, he reached the highest level of the knowledge under his father and also his cousin. Till the moment his father takes him to Karbala, and on their trip to Karbala, they meet Allama Mujahid, who is the son of Sayyid Ali Ghaib Tabatabai, the author of Riyazul Ulama, and they will meet each other over there, and Sayyid Mujahid will ask him one question. I mean, will ask Sheikh Ansari one fiqhi question. The way Sheikh Ansari approaches him in analyzing his question, quoting from different books of the fiqh, Sayyid Mujahid will request the father of Sheikh Ansari, if possible, leave your child with us for some years.
Yes.
I know that he will have the brilliant future. And this is very important to know that Sheikh Ansari was not the man of staying anywhere for a couple years. Because of his knowledge, his talent, his skill, through some years or less than a year, he would understand that, okay, I benefited from this teacher to the maximum level that it was possible for me to benefit from.
Yes.
So we see that in his long trip to Mashhad, when he made his trip to Mashhad, overall it took 6 years. He wanted to meet different ulamas from this fool. Actually, in the...
To Mashhad, to Kashan, to Najaf.
Yes, all those cities, he met all of the ulama, among which only he stayed with Mullah Ahmad al-Naraqi for a couple years.
This is narrated differently.
Okay. Some are saying that 1 year or 2 year, because he is saying that I was actually participating in the dars or in the lesson of the teacher, but I would feel that, okay, I know everything that the teacher is saying, that I don't know if...
Sheikh Ziyaniyat, he becomes the marja a'lam, or we can say the most outstanding marja, after Sahib Jawahir or Muhammad Hassan Najafi. And it is believed that in a session with the presence of so many outstanding maraja and scholars at the city of Najaf, he is introduced by Sheikh al-Najafi as Haza marja'akum min ba'di, that after me, this is your marja, or the most outstanding religious authority. Let's talk a little bit about this, we can say, dimension of the life of Sheikh al-Ansari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Marja'iyat is a position that it is not given to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe many people, they try and they do their best to achieve this position, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala deprived them to achieve it. And maybe some people would run away from this position, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts it on their shoulders. The same case is about Shaykh al-Ansari rahmatullah alayhi.
When that gathering was held in the house of late Marhum Muhammad Hassan al-Najafi, the author of Jawahirul Kalam, maybe some scholars or some teachers were sitting in that room, and they were wishing to be presented as the marja' of Shia of that time. But Sheikh Al-Ansari was not even present at the meeting. And it is quoted that Sheikh Najafi sent someone after him and called him to come. And when he was there, Sheikh Najafi announced him as the next marja' for the Shia population that at that time was more than 40 million people.
And this was not based on personal decision or family relations or something like that.
It was absolutely based
on the level of the knowledge of the Sheikh.
Because okay. Sheikh Najafi was born in Najaf and Sheikh Al-Ansari was born in this school and they were not related to each other at all. And Sheikh Al-Ansari was not a student of Marhum Najafi because he participated in the courses of Marhum Najafi for some months, even not a year. So he was not a famous student of him even. So we should notice that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is promising that when you are doing your best to assist his way, I mean the Almighty's way, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one that he is protecting you. Another important point regarding this is that even after this announcement, Sheikh Al-Ansari was trying to run away from marja'iyyah and to be the source of giving fatwa to people. Even at that time, he said that, okay, Sheikh Najafi has announced me and declared me as the marja', but I had a friend. When we were participating in the courses, there was a friend of mine that he was more talented than me.
Sayyidul Ulama Mazandarani.
Yes. That's right.
Who was on that time living in the northern part of Iran.
In Babul,
in northern part of Iran. That's right.
So Sheikh Al-Ansari sent a letter after him and invited him to take the position of marja'iyyat and said that you were more talented than me. Mm-hmm. Now it's your position here. And Sayyidul Ulama responded that yes, at that time I was more talented, but now I have been away from the teaching
and the courses
of jurisprudence for some years. Now for sure you are more talented than me and you deserve this position.
Okay.
So these are important points regarding his behavior about marja'iyyah. But another dimension of his life is the zuhd, being neglectful toward worldly matters.
Yes.
In his life, this is very important.
Yes.
Because when he was marja', he had access to many properties, because from all over the world they were sending toward him khums, and this was a notable amount of money. But at the end of his life, he had nothing unless 17 dinars. That this amount was exactly equal to the amount that he was in debt. And when they paid his debts, he had nothing. In a way that his descendants, they didn't have money to held the
burial procession
for him and to invite people. And one of the famous merchants of Najaf took the burden of this, meetings and, invitations.
That's right.
So this is very important.
Yes.
Being marja, and beside that, be neglectful toward worldly matters, as we see it in many lives of these scholars. And when we want to talk about the other dimensions of his life, we should mention the dimension of knowledge.
Yes.
This is the most important part of his life in the eyes of ordinary people.
That's
because
right.
People do not know Sheikh Al-Ansari as a man of, asceticism, or does not know him as a man of traveling or as a man of narration, but know him as a man of jurisprudence.
That's inshallah,
we'll talk about it.
I think he was a polymath. We can say an allama, a person who has covered different fields of study in the best way possible. Because when you get to the line of the Urafa, they believe in Sheikh Al-Ansari as a complete arif, a mystic, we can say spiritual trainer and the teacher who, through asceticism and self-training and muraqabah and muhasabah, could reach really high levels. There are, of course, different stories and documents and karamat, referring to the lifestyle of Sheikh Murtaza Al-Ansari. And when you get to the jurisprudential aspect, you can find the author of Rasail and Makasib still are used nowadays in the houses. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's get to the scholar life of Sheikh Al-Ansari. They say that he had some innovations regarding fiqh and usul al-fiqh, and it is shown in the books.
Rasail and Makasib. What details can you give us about this aspect of the life of Sheikh Al-Ansari?
So regarding his scholarly life and specifically Fara'id al-Usul, which is one of the outstanding work which is well known in seminary Hawza, and nowadays they are taking this lesson as a pre-advanced classes to get prepared for participation for the advanced classes. So through this class, they will learn the way they can criticize the ideas of Usul al-Fiqh. One thing that we have to consider is that through Fara'id al-Usul, that is also well known as Rasa'il, and why this yes. name Rasa'il is given, because he's talking about five Rasala in his book.
And Rasala means short treatise.
Yes. But it is not as short as we may consider. Really? Yeah, because in these Fara'id al-Usul, we see in a huge body, he has covered only half of the typical usul al-fiqh.
Okay.
So legal theory in Islamic jurisprudence is composing of two parts. One is mabahis al-lafziyya or mabahis al-alfaz, and the other is usul al-amaliyya.
Yes.
So in Fara'id al-Usul, he has organized usul al-amaliyya. The way the faqih has to approach usul al-amaliyya, starting from the state of certainty or qat. So whenever we are approaching one topic in the fiqh or in the usul, either we have certainty, meaning that we are certain about its ruling, or we don't. So if we do not, then we have different actually classification there, that Sheikh will cover all those classifications there. From his innovation, if you wanted to name and count his innovation in Fara'id al-Usul, for sure there are gonna be very professional issues that maybe it's out of the reach of most of the audience and our listeners.
Yes, for technical terms and technical discussion. That's right.
But just I want to pick one point. For example, this is one of the fiqhi issues that maybe most of the listeners are familiar with. That is the topic of istishab. Mm-hmm. This topic of istishab, before Sheikh Ansari, maximum, it would specify something around less than 50 pages. If you go through all textbook we have before Sheikh Ansari, almost 1,200 years. Why? Because Sheikh Ansari has been born in 1214. So if you consider all of the Usuli books before Sheikh Ansari, the amount of their discussion regarding the istishab will not exceed 50 pages. But when it reached to Sheikh Ansari, we see it will exceed 400 pages.
Oh.
This is only regarding istishab. Okay. So you will see his and all creativity. All of them,
his own argumentations, isn't it?
Yes, and the way it is applied upon the fiqh. It is not only mere creativity to create something and then put it in the book and then you will leave it on your shelf. So we see nowadays all of the mujtahideen are using and applying the fruits of his creativity in usul al-fiqh.
That's right. Okay. Okay, so what about Makasib, Shaykh?
Rasa'il was the book that Shaykh al-Ansari, in that book, is talking about Usul al-Amaliyah. He has also a book, Matarah al-Anzar, in which he discusses about Mabahis al-Alfaz, another discussion in Ilm al-Usul. And then we come to Kitab al-Makasib al-Muharramah, that is the book, a fiqhi book, regarding the Mu'amalat. I mean, this is not also a whole completion of the fiqh, but it's talking only about the transactions.
Yes.
Of course, transactions in fiqh has different meaning than the meaning in
in the business world.
Yeah, in the business world. But I do not want to go through that meaning. But just to mention some points about al-Makasib al-Muharramah is that after about 200 years of the demise of late Sheikh al-Ansari, this book is still standing at the peak level of fiqh. And when the students of the advanced students of fiqh want to get familiar with the manner of ijtihad, they are invited to study the book Al-Makasib al-Muharramah, in which Sheikh al-Ansari tries to give different ideas Of course, many times he does not mention the name of the owner of the idea because he wants to talk briefly. So he gives the idea. He, defends the idea in a way that you believe that, okay, Sheikh Al-Ansari believes in this idea absolutely and completely.
Yes.
And after some lines, he criticizes this idea.
Okay.
You say, okay, this idea is not correct. Mm-hmm. Again, after that, he defends. Again, you say, okay, the criticism is void, and now he again believes. Again, he gives criticism. And in this way, sometimes you may find 10 pages, 20 pages, 30 pages discussing about a single issue mm-hmm. to come to the final decision.
That's right.
This is very important regarding the book of Al-Makasib al-Muharramah. And that's why this book is a notable and a masterpiece of fiqh.
Is this Makasib book because it is, if we want to roughly translate the title, it would be as transactions or something.
Yes.
Or
yes.
The rulings of transactions. Is it at all useful for the public, for example, market people?
You mean to refer to?
To refer to.
They may refer, but understanding the stuff of this book is really hard because
okay.
you cannot find the final idea easily.
Uh-huh.
You have to be familiar with technical terms of ilm al-usul,
okay.
the technical terms of ilm al-rijal,
okay.
the technical terms of ilm al-hadith to get the exact point of this book. So if you are not knowing the, for example, the meaning of hadith al-da'if, hadith al-mursal,
mm-hmm.
you don't know the meaning of, for example, istishab, you don't know the yes. meaning of ijma', you don't know the meaning of shuhra, what is the difference yes. between these two? So then this book is not giving you, fruitful ideas.
But for sure the maraji in writing the sections on answering the religious questions of transactions and business has benefited very much from this book, okay?
For sure,
so,
yeah.
So when an ordinary person, like a Muslim or a Shia Muslim, refers to a Rasale Amaliyah, for sure he is finding the simplified version of Rasale Makasib, in the business world.
Plus, your point, we should mention that trading law in Iran, many of the articles of this law mm-hmm. are abstracted from the ideas of Sheikh al-Ansari in Al-Makasib al-Muharramah.
That's right.
So, okay. yeah, ordinary people are getting benefited from this book indirectly.
Yes.
But directly, it's really hard okay. for them to get benefit from this book.
Thank you much, Sheikh Madavi and Sheikh Ziya Inia for your
welcome.
Elaboration on the life account of Sheikh Murtaza Ansari Desbuli, mainly known as Sheikh al-Ansari, the author of Al-Rasail and Al-Makasib. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program and to download for free our previous episodes, refer to our website, parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.